Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Army Benevolent Fund. As the charity enters its 80th anniversary year, we open with every best wish and all good luck for 2024. My guest for the January edition of General Talk is a journalist and noted war correspondent, whose writing, despite his protestations to the contrary, ranks readily with the likes of Martha Gellhorn, Norman Lewis, or Richard Dimbleby. The very nature of his story gathering places him at the very heart of conflict, be it Bosnia, Chechnya, Afghanistan, the Central African Republic, or Ukraine, requiring great courage, guile and determination to ensure the core issues at stake and the human elements behind them are reported in full. Now senior foreign correspondent of the Times, for whom he has written for over 30 years, he is Anthony Lloyd, who began his career as an officer in the Royal Green Jackets. Our conversation, which took place in December, begins by discussing the changing nature of modern warfare. I hope you enjoy the programme.
But it's funny what you said about how brutal wars are now. I think in some ways it's very different. I mean, there's not one Western reporter in Gaza. Not one.
They're all embedded, as it were, in Israeli communities. The chances, therefore, to report impartially, you know, must be much harder.
Well, certainly it's impossible to report from the ground, apart from if you're a Palestinian journalist.
The Palestinian journalists out there are doing some really brave stuff, aren't they?
Because yeah, and also dying, you know, hand over fist. All our families are getting whacked too. Yeah. I mean, Jesus Christ. Can you imagine the stress of working, trying to work, covering a war, a very violent war, with your family there too?
Admiral John Coward, who commanded, I think, Britain in the Falklands, once said, he said that moderation in war is imbecility. And
he said, moderation is imbecility.
Yeah, in war.
I think that holds anymore. I challenge him totally on that. But I think those days are gone. I think the lessons now of war, as proved in Afghanistan and Iraq, is that your overarching ability to kill almost anybody you want and military superiority, the more strongly it is used, the further you fail. And I'm absolutely sure that Israel will fail. I am absolutely sure they will fail, morally, legally, in terms of efficacy. They will fail for all the lessons that we have failed in Iraq, in Afghanistan, because people have not got the lesson learned from what the Admiral said about moderation as imbecility, because it's no longer applicable. And they follow that lesson into a new generation of war, in a new informational space, and people won't have it. People won't have it in the public. They don't buy the stuff that they used to buy in terms of information. And you will repel the population who are the strategic ground against your aim. I'm absolutely sure Israel, who is not showing moderation, will fail.
We've got two major conflicts on our hands. We've got Israel, Hamas, and we've got Ukraine and Russia. So NATO is throwing much of its might behind Ukraine. But actually, what do you think the prognosis is in the long term for that? Because the arsenals of NATO are now running dry. There's no guarantee that America will back Ukraine going further forward, or to the extent it has done, especially if President Trump gets in. What's your view on the Ukraine-Russian war now?
I think the advantage of the war has switched to Russia. Perhaps it was always with Russia, but it's certainly switched to Russia. I think that the West failed to take on board the lessons of the past and conflicts with Russia, including the Second World War. But since the Second World War, conflicts such as Chechnya, which was a small war, but extremely violent war, in which we saw the same template evolve, whereby Russia suffered egregious early setback, but then regathered itself and ploughed on ahead, irregardless of casualties, over a very protracted period of time, and with a very simple and focused aim. That behaviour set is in play again in Ukraine. I think, certainly Russia under Putin at least, And if he went, I don't think there'll be a radical shift in Russian strategy vis-a-vis Ukraine. Is singular in its singly minded. It is an approach which doesn't pay much attention to casualties. It is not a democracy, so there is nothing for him to fear in an election. And the industrial, military industrial capabilities of Russia are much more coherent than we have believed and can replace their equipment losses at a far greater rate than the West. I think the Ukrainian counteroffensive of the summer was a salient lesson, both in the limitations of NATO, in its ability to train and equip Ukraine for that kind of offensive in so short a space of time. And expected far too much of the Ukrainians. I think the Ukrainians, elements of them, probably expected far too much themselves too. And overall, I think the message was further complicated by a kind of complicit media here that sold the message so much like plucky Ukraine, soon they're going to kick the Russians out of Ukraine and they're going to repel the Russians here. Now, most people want that to happen. So we see and understand the war through an emotional prism, quite understandably, of wanting Ukraine to win. But unfortunately, the reality was that Ukraine was and is now far more challenged than that kind of media messaging allowed for. It was going against what's the second most powerful army in the world, an army with a history of recollecting itself, gathering itself from setback and ploughing on ahead over very long periods of time. And as opposed to Western impatience, war exhaustion. It's not our exhaustion, it's essentially getting bored with the war. NATO divisions in Europe. You don't see those kind of divisions in Russia. There's the odd left field glitch, the joker in the pack in the case of Prigozhin, for example, marching suddenly on Moscow. Something you couldn't have predicted happening, which does suddenly happen. But after that, the still of the pool returns.
And don't forget, fatal air accident which he mysteriously died in. How convenient that was going to happen.
It's amazing he even got on a plane. I mean, I don't think there was any air accident about it. He was shot down by anti-aircraft fire. But yeah. I'm amazed he got on that plane.
Sorry, don't rest that out. Yeah. But it's amazing he lasted that long, I think.
Amazing he lasted that long. Amazing he thought he felt safe enough to fly with his closest entourage at the point in time he did. But sorry, in short, to go back to your original question, you'll either see 2024 as a year in which Ukraine is fixed in a really defensive war, or you'll see Ukraine increasingly isolated, short of funding, short of weapons, being pressurized by various Western countries to try and sue for peace, some sort of negotiated settlement with Russia. Whether or not that is possible, I don't know, but I think that's the pressure. I think Ukraine has got next to no chance of getting Crimea back. Very little chance of getting the lost territories back in Donbass. There is a chance for a more equitable negotiated settlement or a more balanced negotiated settlement if they can bring Crimea into missile range. You know, if they can hit the Kerch Bridge more often, you'll get a more, you know, slightly more strategic match in terms of negotiation. But at the moment, I would imagine that President Putin has good reasons for feeling confident in the long term as to forcing the Ukrainians into a position of negotiation that's advantageous to Russia.
The weak pin in all this, as I see it, is NATO. So it could have stepped the mark when America pulled out of Afghanistan in 2021. Yet again, it has failed to defend democracy when it should technically, although Ukraine is not a member of NATO, it is in NATO's interest technically to step up to defend a democracy. Do you think NATO will ever actually go to war in its own right?
First, I disagree with a couple of things there. I don't think NATO would have had a chance in stepping up to the plate in Afghanistan after America pulled out its asset. No way. It didn't have similar assets and it certainly didn't have similar will. There was no way that was ever going to happen, nor could have happened, to my mind. And vis-a-vis Ukraine, no, you don't get a singular... Technically, NATO is singular-minded in one respect, its response if a member is attacked. But in terms of supporting a non-member, then it is a divided organisation, as we see. The proof of the pudding, which I hope is never realised, is what happens if some of the predictions that Putin will, you know, eventually attack a NATO member in the East are challenged. Then what's going to happen? It depends who's attacked. Well, if it's Poland that was attacked, I would think there'll be a pretty coherent response from NATO. Right. What happens if someone, you know, what happens if Romania was attacked? I don't know.
Let's then look at the state of the British Army. You mentioned Iraq, you mentioned Afghanistan. What do you think the state of our army is today? How do you see it as an outsider with all your experience of warfare over 30 years?
I'd observed the British Army, I suppose, as a journalist, quite closely through various embeds, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The last time I saw the British Army really up close over the other side of the airport fence in Afghanistan, pulling Brits out and Afghans out, while I was on the Taliban side of the fence. But I think that intervention goes in cycles. It's always very difficult to predict what the length of each of those cycles is. But after Afghanistan, after Ukraine, given the state of Britain's economy at the moment, given the underfunding in its army, it is highly unlikely that we will see an intervention of the type and school of Kosovo, Sierra Leone, Afghanistan or Iraq for a very, very long time. Right. Intervention's got a bad name, which is sad because some of the interventions, especially the smaller ones, Kosovo and Sierra Leone, were successful. And then the biggest, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq were clearly not only not successful, but I mean, they were failures. They were, fairly enough, called defeats. It's a tough word to wrestle with, but I mean, you know, British officers don't like it necessarily, but I mean, definitely in Afghanistan. And Iraq, you know, kind of muddle it through now and say, well, perhaps it wasn't as bad as it could have been, but I mean, Iran is left as the dominant regional neighbour of Iraq. You know, American troops are harassed almost on a daily basis by rocket fire or attacks at the moment. And I would imagine that the fallout from Gaza will mean that America, and by its nature, Britain as a key ally, certainly in the recent Security Council vote on ceasefire in Gaza, will be edged out of the Middle East. You know, there are not a lot of people in the Middle East who like the British and American stance in Gaza at the moment. There's a seismic shift in judgment and opinion over America, over American positioning in the Middle East, which I think will likely increase in the wake of whatever happens in Gaza now. And Britain is attached to America in many people's minds, so I think British position in the Middle East will also be weaker. I think one thing will be very difficult for America to do again, and it really undermines the carefully built and structured support of Ukraine, is to advocate campaigns, operations, wars, defensive wars, advertised as, you know, protection of human rights or democracy.
An eye for an eye, we've slightly gone over that, haven't we, with Israel and Hamas?
Yeah, in terms of proportionality, that's you know, that's gone. In terms of justifying the, you know, daily slaughter of women and children, you can't really come back and say, oh yeah, but Russia kills civilians in Ukraine, right, when you've just been supporting exactly that in Gaza, and supporting not just, you know, politically, but in terms of tank shells.
The one thing about the Israel-Hamas war is that there seems to be no desire to, at some point, work out the long-term solution, which must be peace.
The long-term solution has to be peace, and wars do come to an end. They might become frozen and rekindle, or they might actually end someday. I see no plan at all. I mean, they cannot and should not expel the Gaza population into where? Into Egypt. Egypt won't want them.
No.
And why should they be expelled? It's their land.
Mm. We first met 30 years ago in the Maglite pocket. Yeah. As I was walking with my hands in the air down a very lonely road to try and feed off the Maglite population there. You just left the Royal Green Jackets. I remember a long-haired youth with a willy-willy beard in a tight biker jacket.
I didn't have a beard. No. There was no willowy beard for years. I know you're looking more.
All right, the long hair. And a biker's jacket and some ripped jeans, which must have been the most uncomfortable thing to be wearing in the Bosnian winter.
Yeah.
What was the attraction? Yeah, cold. What was the attraction there that drew you into war journalism? Because then you went out as a photographer, didn't you?
Yeah, I'd started off as a photographer, but I'd left the army in 1991, and I was bored by the time I left. I wasn't bored of the whole experience. I had some great times, really enjoyable times. I met people who really interested me. And I met some jerks too. But I was bored. I didn't want to be a career soldier. I had joined it sort of for the experience, wanting some excitement. And yet the army I joined at the tail end of the Cold War. I've been to Northern Ireland, obviously, before, when Ireland was still a troubled place. And that was really interesting, but it certainly wasn't a war, and thank God. And then I went to the Gulf for the first Gulf War, which was very brief and, endless expanses of desert. And by that stage, I'd done 5 years, and I was like, I definitely don't want to stay in the army. And I'm still curious to see what, war really looks like, and I don't want to stay on in the army. It could be years and years before it has another one, and it's not an environment that I particularly want to be in for my professional life. And so I'd left. I was curious enough in journalism. I mean, I was kind of not super keen to be a journalist, but probably more interested in journalism than I had been when I first joined the army. I was kind of like a bit curious and quite keen, but not that keen. So I went off to London College of Printing, studied photojournalism for a year. At that time, Yugoslavia was beginning to fall apart. So when I left London College of Printing in 1992, September 1992, summer 92, war was on in Croatia still, and war had just begun in Bosnia. And so I wrote letters to newspapers saying, hey, I've just done this course in photojournalism, will you employ me to go to Bosnia and take photographs for you? And of course, people either didn't write back or said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. And because it was a close enough war, it was in Europe, I mean, you could fly to Zagreb within an hour and a half, 2 hours from London, and then you could get into Bosnia through a number of ways. I just, thought, well, it's quite a fork in the road moment. Either you're going to do this, or you're going to blanch at the idea of going it alone, and in which case you're probably never going to do it. And so I was quite singular about it. I got very, very kind of fit as a way of just getting my head together to concentrate on it. I learnt the rudiments of Serbo-Croatian. I worked hard with cameras every day. And then I went. I hitchhiked with two friends as far as Hungary, then got a train down to Croatia. And then I got a bus to Split. And then in those days, you could get on a UN flight in Sarajevo with just the kind of scantiest suggestion of press accreditation. And I worked out a plan. I knew a Bosnian family. Bosnian Serb family, actually, with whom to stay inside the city. Obviously, there were no phone links or anything like that, but I'd worked out where their address was with their family, actually, in London. And so that was the beginning of a plan. So I went, essentially, because I was very curious. And, it was fascinating. It was a war you could cover from living among the community who were involved in the war. It was very rarely hotel life. It was, a lot of time I spent in central Bosnia living in the house of a woman who I stayed in touch with for years until her death a few years ago. I spoke the language enough to get by. I had a car. It was...
Marrakesh is... I always felt that, for example, in Magdala, you got there before we did, and you were on the inside. You'd been there sort of two nights already before we got there. And I just got the sense of it was hard, it was risky, dangerous, and you were always taking risks day in, day out to get whatever we needed to do the story. And you got it. You started to get the name that way. But it was by taking huge risks at your own personal expense often.
It's easier because your sense of mortality is not as evolved and you become more wary of risk. One, with the natural you know, progression of thought as you get older, you can hear the storm coming. But also, when by the, you know, the number of mortal experiences you have, or the number of encounters you have with mortal threat, then naturally you begin to accumulate a lot more wariness over risk, much more aware of what happens when things go wrong.
Do you think you've had your nine lives yet? Are you worried about your nine lives?
Not particularly. My engagement around risk is different age 57 to how it would be at 27. And actually the wars I'm currently involved in reporting are sort of different. I mean, Ukraine, it's interesting. People say, oh my God, you're going to Ukraine. What's that like? Well, from the moment you cross the Ukrainian border in Poland, you've got the same amount of distance as if you drove from London to Berlin before you get somewhere where you're reasonably in mid-range of artillery out in Donbass. That's an awful lot of distance. In that distance, you can stay in quite nice hotels, you can eat really well, and you will be in a population overwhelmingly who not only consent to you being there, but like you being there because you're a Brit. Now, that's quite a rare war zone for me to work in. There's not that, I don't usually have that luxury of that expansive territory where I haven't got anything to worry about. I haven't got the luxury usually of working among people who I would trust the whole time, not only never to harm me, but to actually like and help me. You know, in some ways, that makes the Ukrainian war a very easy war to cover. Also, the Ukrainians are very controlling when it comes to the actual battle space. It's not, you know, it's just, you know, go up to a unit and say, hey, can I go to your front line? It's not like that at all. It's a very controlled process to access a particular sector of the front or a unit. And it's comparatively rare. I mean, I can think a few really dangerous experiences I've had in Ukraine, a couple this year. Whereas other wars I've covered, I don't know, Afghanistan at times, or certainly places like Syria or Chechnya, acutely violent, 360-degree risk environment. And never be sure of being able to trust the people you're working alongside. You could never be sure of the consent of the local people for you being there. And it was, you know, you were stressed 24/7.
Yep. As the Times foreign correspondent, you are very well known. You are an asset for capture. Like, and again, or imprisonment, like the American journalist who's currently residing in Moscow. You haven't got the luxury of armies of chains of command behind you to support you in that sense. So you're really out on a limb. That must play on your mind a bit more and more, doesn't it?
Well, it depends on the war. I don't think anyone's going to, you know, try and capture me in Ukraine. In Afghanistan, no, I thought the dynamic was different. I wasn't worried about that there. In Syria, it was a worry, and it, you know, became a big worry. I did get abducted in Syria.
You were shot twice.
Yeah. It depends. It depends on the war. But also, Evans' imprisonment in Russia was quite specific to not necessarily him as an individual, but Russia wanting a political hostage to fortune. And he entered that broadband of desire of the Russians. And they took him and they've got him. And I would be... Okay, so one where it did play into my mind and where Evans' fate played into my mind was in the Central African Republic this May. Central African Republic, obviously controlled by the Wagner Group, really for a couple of years now. Hundreds, if not thousands, of Wagner Group operatives there. The government entirely allied to the Russians and particularly to Wagner Group. No friends there, isn't it? Not like a British embassy or anything like that. And so I went in there for, I think, 10 days to report. And there, I was self-conscious about it. I mean, I was thinking, right, I am the only British journalist here. And I am asking questions about Wagner Group's involvement. And it's going to upset people, certainly interest people. The surveillance was quite heavy. There was direct, you know, surveillance on me. Sometimes it would be semi-clandestine. It would be a camera in a cigarette packet on top of a book on the table next to you in, you know, the restaurant or the hotel. Sometimes it'd be people filming you. Sometimes it'd be a vehicle with masked men pulling up alongside you to stare you out. So you were made to feel uncomfortable, but at the same time, I've been under surveillance in a more aggressive way than that. So I was like, they want to make me feel uncomfortable. They want to keep an eye on me, but they don't really want to freak me out. They want to freak me out a bit. So, and I was thinking then, it'd be too much to arrest me and deport me to Moscow. So that's not going to happen. But I could really do without being arrested and put in a local prison as well. But that probably won't happen. I don't know. So it depends on the environment. In many places I work, like Ukraine, it doesn't worry me at all. In some places it does worry me.
You talk about, let's go back quickly to the Wagner Group, to their involvement in the Central African Republic. Is that now an active franchise of the Wagner Group, or is that now directly under control of Moscow?
I really want to go back and find out. I would imagine it has been co-opted far more under the control of Moscow. But I should really go back to check that one out. The fate of the Wagner Group after Prigozhin's killing remains a mystery to me.
How much inspiration do you take from your great-grandfather, who was one of the greatest generals in the army of our time, General Sir Carleton de Wyatt, Victoria Cross?
None. He's interesting. Interesting guy. Much more complex man. So this was a guy who was wounded, 11 times? He lost his eye.
Pulled his own fingers off.
pulled his own fingers off after the doctors refused to amputate him from his
shattered hand. I remember what I was saying. He didn't mind which side he fought on, as long as he fought in the war at some point.
Yeah, because he wasn't a British citizen originally. Which that identity I do carry. My family feels a foreign family. We've got a lot of European blood, a lot of Belgian blood, a lot of German blood. So the whole thing of, you know, British or English national identity is always slightly kind of irrelevant, I would say, to me personally. Carleton de Wyatt, he was studying at university. I can't remember if he was at Cambridge. He was at Cambridge or Oxford. The Boer War started. He tried to join the British Army. They said he wasn't a British citizen. So he was like, well, I don't really mind. I'll go off and join the Boers. But along the way, he got picked up by the Brits. And that's how he sort of ended up the hero of the British Army without actually being British. He did get British citizenship in the end. He was his own guy. I mean, I kind of, read about him, and he's a maverick guy, very eccentric guy. He had, as far as I can work out, no concept of physical fear. Now, I know what physical fear is like. I feel quite unnerved if I'm with people who haven't got a concept of physical fear. I'm like, it doesn't smell right to me. I don't want to be around you making complicated assessments because you don't kind of get it. But he clearly didn't have that. And yet, I think he was far better. He's been quite, in some ways, quite mocked. I mean, even in war, his character, Brigadier Richie Hook, was based on Carleton de Wyatt. It's not a very nice character. It's a kind of madman who cuts off heads and all the rest of it. I think Carleton de Wyatt's much more sensitive than that. I came across a really interesting biography that was written of him recently, and it describes Carleton de Wyatt as recalled by a young officer in 1917. They went down to a bunker to receive orders for some ghastly attack, and Carleton de Wyatt was there. He was giving the orders. And first of all, Carleton de Wyatt read through the brief and the orders from headquarters and looked at them and threw them over his shoulder into the bin and said, well, look, let's ignore those. It's going to be like this. And he gave them a very simple set of orders that was very clear, but it was also very empathetic. It wasn't like, just go over until the last man of you's left alive and keep going. Yeah. It was, the picture painted was of this good-humoured and empathetic and quite sensitive man actually giving orders to some young officers who were going to be in the thick of it within a few hours with their guys. And it was a very different image. His physical courage was immense, but I think some people feel like, oh, this is great grandson, you in thrall of him. No, I feel he's a really interesting and eccentric member of my family. And we're proud in a balanced way to be a Victoria Cross family. It was his Victoria Cross. It's not our Victoria Cross. But at the same time, you know, he won at the Somme on the second day, and that still resonates with us in some way, and I think quite a healthy way. I've been out to the Somme two or three times and always found it quite a actually quite a spiritual place, and that's what I would connect more with than in thinking, hey, he was a really brave guy, I've got to be a brave guy too. My relationship with courage or with an awareness of mortal threat is quite balanced. I find we're quite chemical beings. Some days it's quite easy to be brave and sometimes it's a bit more difficult to be brave. It's not always logical. Something can be very loud and close and you feel quite cool. Sometimes it's just an empty road and distant gunfire and you're thinking, oh, don't push it today, Lloyd. Today something could go wrong. It's one of those days. I feel quite, you know, calm about the whole thing. It does, it helps getting shot twice as well. It's kind of like, okay, be sensible.
But you go routinely into high level areas of conflict, take great risks, we've discussed already. You've got to think on your feet, you've got to get the story out, you write beautifully in the process. But it must take its toll. You must think, you must see the soldiers on the front line who are losing their lives, or the pitiful, you know, acts of violence going all around you. And it must take its effect. Do you think there'll come the day when suddenly you say, enough's enough?
Yes, I do. It's funny, in some ways, I'm very good at compartmentalising things. I find myself quite easy returning to a Devon life from an assignment. And immediately I have helpful demands placed on me. Here, very simple ones, I walk the dogs or get my daughter to college or, you know, bloody blah, let the chickens out or whatever. However, I do notice that, all that said, I will get extremely upset from time to time when I reflect on something that has happened in a war. And it's not to do with the echoes, I would suggest, of trauma or post-trauma, but more the fucking sorrow of so much of what I see, the suffering or the hurt or thinking of the grief in a mother whose child has just been blasted in a smear of gristle and blood up a wall, or vice versa, some kid whose parents have just been annihilated without the chance to say goodbye. That will kind of catch up with me more. That sorrow, that will get me more. I mean, it's not like I'm walking around wailing all day, but I mean, I could do some days.
There is a sense that if you look for it, you'll find it. And forgive me for asking about this, but you did have trouble with heroin, didn't you?
Harry. It was
must have been PTSD related in a way.
No, it wasn't. I can dispel that very easily. I think it was something I wrote about when I wrote a book, which is now about nearly 30 years old, My War Gone By, which was a road memoir, basically, of the Bosnian War. But I think what I tried to pick out in that was that, and I lived with a heroin habit for a few years, was that I was always the kind of person who was going to be attracted to drugs. As I get less hooked on the term drug or addiction, then I like that kind of edgy experience. And it was an experience which also drove a desire for that kind of edgy experience, which took me out to Bosnia. That kind of appetite was both healthy and unhealthy. Healthy in that it could take you to some fairly curious places and to learn things, and unhealthy, it can end up taking smack, becoming an addict. And so the two did kind of get entangled and entwined. It would be lovely and simplistic and wrong to say that I took heroin as a result of what I'd seen in the Bosnian War. It was all part of the same.
Keep the high going, do you think, as it were?
I tell you what it did do. I don't know about keeping the high going, but it would certainly head off the low pretty strongly. By which I mean, there is a crash down. I notice it, particularly now I'm older. And you're coming back from a war assignment, and you are adrenalized to some extent throughout the whole of that. If it's 3 weeks in Ukraine, some of that may be spent in quite peaceable land, but you're still thinking okay, what's going to happen tomorrow and how am I going to do this? And quite a selfish, just driven decision process going on. And then suddenly you get back home and the first few nights, you know, my whatever valve used to kind of, you know, let off that kind of adrenaline process that used to calm down. Now it doesn't, I stay adrenalized for several days. I can't sleep at night. Then I kind of get a real crash. Now, when that was going on in my youth, coming back from Bosnia from long stints, like, you know, 3-4 months, and coming back, and probably not being around for that long, maybe a month or two back in the UK before going back out. If you took heroin, you just never had to go through any of that. The whole thing was just kind of smoothed over until you next went out there.
Yeah.
You feel pretty ill then, but anyway, it wasn't. I've never worked out the perfect solution to this, Harry, but there we go. It's been a long time since taking heroin, so that wasn't.
That's the mystery of life.
Yeah.
What drives you to have your life on the line on a routine basis and to get that story home? What is it? What's the motivation for you personally?
I have a great curiosity and I have a great sense of adventure, and it's always a bit of an adventure for me. That's why I still do it. I'm lucky with the niche I've got, but long may it last. But, you know, talk over the kind of rough mission statement with my boss, like, okay, it's going to be about 3 weeks and some of it's going to be spent here and some of it's going to be spent there. He never tells me what to do. I kind of suggest to him what I'd like to do and he either agrees or disagrees, and then it's, you know, pick up $8,000 in cash and you'll need that because I need that to pay people in liquid cash, and off you go. It's a little bit more chaperone than it was now, and that, you know, I've got various kind of apps now on a phone which, if there is a signal, kind of relay to people in pretty much real time where I am and things, so if things go wrong they can kind of pick me up quicker.
You haven't got a phone signal here. Yeah, you've got a fancy
one. Yeah, I know. It is really strange. I get the same excitement some people have on holiday, which sounds weird.
You've got one of the greatest shows perhaps in journalism today. You're up there with William Howard Russell, with Martha Gellhorn, Max Hastings, Richard Dimbleby, people like that, but you are, it's true.
No, you're right. I don't know about that, Harry. I mean, I like a compliment, but I'm not sure about that. I've done okay. I'm confident at where I am, but, you know, there's a lot of other... There's different capabilities in different wings of journalism. I would say that, you know, Win Behind Me and Good Going, I'm pretty good at a conflict, particularly a small war where there's not many other journalists around, where I have space to operate, to gain some trust with people and to engage with it. And conflicts like Afghanistan, where it's all about getting out there on the ground and engaging with people, and very different people, I mean, Taliban, whoever, I'm pretty good at that. If you look at something at the moment, which is a really serious conflict in Gaza, well, one of the reasons I'm not there is because you're not reporting that from in Gaza, because you're not allowed in. You're reporting it from in Israel, and you need to be very knowledgeable as the historical and cultural ground that you're in, the information space that you're in, and you need to be turning around a hard news, well, you need to be engaged with a hard news cycle on a daily basis that's very acute, very intense, very fast moving, and largely done, not exclusively, but largely done from an office. And that's a real demand. I'm shit at things like that.
Even among the pain and fear, the bloody wounds and the unending crash of shellfire, there was a place for stoicism and dark humour. Oleg Ilchinsky, 54, and his wife Victoria, 47, both lawyers, talked about having lunch at their kitchen table. They had just opened a bottle of Italian wine when a rocket destroyed their apartment around them, wounding them both with a wave of glass and shrapnel. The balcony disappeared in an instant, torn away. The windows blew in upon us in a storm of blast and heat, she said. The furniture blew to smithereens as we smashed into the fridge, which joined us rolling down the corridor covered in blood. Amid it all, the bottle of red stood untouched. I'll never forget that weird detail. Minutes after the blast, as they staggered from the ruins of their home and collapsed into the arms of rescuers, Victoria's phone rang. It was the couple's 15-year-old daughter calling from Brussels to check that they were all right. So I took the call, covered in blood in the street, our home obliterated behind us, dust and smoke everywhere, glass sticking out of my skin, barely able to stand. I took a deep breath, gathered myself and said, "Don't worry, darling, everything is just fine here."
Tim Bentinck, reading a dispatch written shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in early 2022 by my guest, the Times senior foreign correspondent, Anthony Lloyd.
I love that, because again, as a parent, you just want to, you know, reassure children, well, everything's fine, covered in blood, the flat's gone up in smoke, just taking a direct hit by, you know, Katyusha.
Looking back over 30 years of war correspondence, yeah. Is there any particular moment you think, crikey, we had a lot of fun there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So Bosnia when I started, and I was, you know, in my mid-20s then, I found a set of people who, for the first time in my life, I felt really at home with, and that was, you know, fellow correspondents and photographers in that time. I found them fascinating, interesting, funny, and I felt like I was part of a good gang for the first and probably only time in my life. But that and that's not the same now, because I'm old and I work alone and, you know, we old gangers are gone. But so that was a fascinating time. It was a really intense learning time as well. I didn't really have a thought in my brain before I went to Bosnia. There was plenty going on while I was in Bosnia. And the other highs, I think, were going to Afghanistan in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 with a great friend of mine, Seamus Murphy. And working there, I think it was about 2.5-3 months, we crossed over from Tajikistan, hooked up with old Northern Alliance units we knew, drove across the mountains down into Panjshir, and then waited with the Mujahideen army that was growing on the Shamali Plain to retake Kabul from the Taliban. That was an amazing and wild, wild time. One of the times we really look at our history is, you know,
stuff's a big game.
Yeah. Then Afghanistan, in the last 3 years before the withdrawal, I was working in a more and more lonely space there, which I like, particularly at my age, that we're seeing other journalists. And now I try and keep just working alone, because I find it, white noise of other people affects my mind. And if I can just work alone without other foreigners, it's a purer workspace. Yeah, those were really fascinating, really enjoyable times.
Don McCullen, probably one of the greatest war photographers of art, is now photographing Somerset Levels and ruins the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
What next for Frantic?
I'm not done yet. The desire for me to travel is still there. The desire to engage in conflict is still there. The thing that bothers me now is, which is another reflection of age, is how does the information which I have tried to on pass to people across the years, admittedly, with the desire for a great deal of adventure and fun along the way, you know, that was always the motivation, how is that utilised to make society better? And I look at the world now and I think the world is not better. I'm not saying I was in this job to make the world a better place, but now at 57 I look back and I think, hey, maybe I did want to make it a better place. I certainly want to make it a better place than it is now. Is there something else that you could do, even at this kind of maybe not last length of your life, but, you know, you've gone way past the halfway point here, Lloyd, to, you know, put my shoulder to the wheel a bit, or even if not necessarily so altruistic, but just to be able to do something in a slightly deeper or more spiritual medium. I don't know. So I'm sort of grappling with all that. But I mean, hey, January the 5th, I'll be on a plane to Poland and we'll go over to Ukraine, so it's not going to stop yet.
I don't see you doing children's books quite yet, do you?
No, but funnily enough, the idea to write a really good, dark children's book, you know, Murder of the Gnomes or something like that.
Wasn't quite how I was thinking. I think at that point, we draw a line. Thank you so much for being my guest on General Talk.
Thanks, Harry.
And my thanks once again to Anthony Lloyd, whose reports from the front lines of Ukraine can be read in the Times, while his two books, My War Gone By and Another Bloody Love Letter, are available for purchase online. If you enjoy this podcast and would like to hear more, then visit the growing library of past editions, which can be found at armybenevolentfund.org. Do join us next month. And until then, from me, Harry Bucknell, thank you for listening and farewell. Royal Green Jackets Regimental Quick March was played by the Buglers and Band of the Royal Green Jackets. Studio editing by Michael Stigliano. This has been a GameCube production for the Army Benevolent Fund.
What next for Mark Lloyd? Frankie Lloyd.
How funny I have to edit that bit out.